Hi, this is Isaac Arthur. Welcome to the show, and don't forget to check out this month's Nebula exclusive, Giant Space Monsters. To get access and help support the show while hearing every episode early and ad-free, plus hours of bonus content, check out go.nebula.tv/Isaac Arthur and use my code Isaac Arthur. The Sun is a lonely star, its many planets millions or even billions of miles away, and with no kindred star within trillions. And yet many stars dance together eternally in binary or even trinary pairs, and we may come to live on planets with two or even three sunrises one day. So today we'll be looking at the habitability of binary star systems and trinary or multi-star systems too, along with how and why we might colonize them. Now, we used to say that most stars were in binary or multi-star systems, so the issue of colonizing them if they might have habitable planets seemed pretty important. But we have since learned that's not really the case. In astronomy, we disproportionately see the great big stars, which have great big gravity wells, and they are far more likely to have formed with a binary partner and kept that partner. Or indeed partners, as we can have triple and quadruple star systems, or even more. And as we talked about last month in Primordial Planets and Multiplanetary Empires, most stars form in clusters and slowly get those perturbed apart as they wander around the galaxy and have bigger members detonate as supernovae. Our episode today is more on binaries and trinary systems, though. Also, while we're not fixated on using the classic definition of a habitable zone or Goldilocks zone to mean the region around a star in which planets can have surface oceans of water, not ice, or some Venusian hellscape, it is the default meaning of the term habitable zone or Goldilocks zone, not too cold, not too hot, just right for surface water. With binaries, that can get a bit more tricky, since a planet might orbit both and move in and out of the habitable zone and remain habitable. So too, a system in which Earth-like life can emerge on its own not only does not rule out life using other chemistries, but also does not well represent what sort of planets we can settle. As we discussed in Multiplanetary Empires last month, even ignoring all the space habitats or asteroid colonies we might construct, we can make a lot of planets that are a bit cold or hot quite temperate by use of relatively simple orbital mirrors or shades, whose construction and maintenance would be orders of magnitude simpler and cheaper than terraforming that planet would be. We also have to move the habitable zone further out if discussing a large habitable moon, as those tend to be warmer from receiving not just sunlight, but tidal heating from their parent planet. Incidentally, for channel regulars curious why I mentioned an episode last month, an episode I created last year on Nebula, the original version of this episode, Colonizing Binary Stars, aired on Nebula back in April of 2023, and as a companion video to our episode Life on Giant Moons, itself originally named Colonizing Giant Moons. But as I was writing this week's other episode, Colonizing White Dwarfs, and reviewing this one in preparation for a general release to YouTube and our other platforms, I decided there was more to say on the topic. And since this and next month's Space Freighters episode were also the last Nebula exclusives I recorded before I got the nose and tongue surgery to help correct my speech impediment last May, I felt like they deserved updated audio. And that gave me open license to tweak and add to the original script, too. Even with that and a year of aggressive speech therapy, there is still some impediment left, so if you're new to the show and wondering what I just got done rambling about, feel free to turn on the captions. Now, one of the critical things to understand about binaries and trinaries is that they are rarely the same mass as their partner, and this massively alters what their habitable zones look like. A second thing to understand is that their mass and brightness will often change over time, and the star which was originally brighter will die before its twin, first brightening to be a subgiant, then becoming a massive red giant, then turning into a much dimmer white dwarf, and then possibly going nova, sometimes even repeatedly, and even supernova, a type 1a supernova specifically, by stealing mass off its binary partner, which typically leaves no remnant. Some stars used to be binary, and now no longer have even a white dwarf companion left. They are all alone, except maybe for a zombie star in some cases. Ironically, the vampiric mass theft off their longer-lived partner, in further lowering their mass, actually extends their lifetime, so maybe vampiric isn't the right way to think of it, but vampires and zombies are catchy terms. Also, their shift into a planetary nebula between red giant and white dwarf phases leaves a lot of matter hanging around their smaller partner might have gobbled up, so the vampire might be stealing some of it back. Anyway, that's a key first point. Whether we're talking about binary stars or binary planets, there's not a lot of cases where they are the same size. Alpha Centauri A and B, for instance, are fairly similar in size, but A is still 20% more massive than B, and also fully 3 times brighter. Mass is hugely important to star luminosity, as is age, so a star twice as massive is likely to be 10 to 12 times brighter, and that means its habitable radius is about 3.5 times wider, too. Ironically, the mass sensitivity is reversed for double planets. Their surface gravity varies way less by mass than stellar luminosity does. See our Double Planets episode for discussion of that, but again, stars vary heavily in brightness by their mass. Specifically, our Sun is exactly 1 solar mass, and has exactly 1 solar luminosity for its brightness. It's the basis for the system, and Earth is the basis for the astronomical unit, or AU, how far we are from the Sun. Our first modern estimate from 60 years ago had us roughly in the middle of the habitable zone, itself stretching from 0.74 AU to 1.24 AU, though most modern ones usually place us closer to the inner edge at about 0.9 AU, and the outer edge sometimes even out past 2 AU. How does that vary for binaries? Well, let's look at the individual stars first. Alpha Centauri B, also known as Toulomin, has a mass of 0.909 solar masses, 91% of our Sun's mass, and a brightness of 49.8% of our Sun's, and both stars are about the same age as our Sun, so that brightness difference is all from the mass, just 9% less mass but half the brightness, and on its own it would have a habitable zone 71% as far from it as our own Sun's habitable zone is. Alpha Centauri A, also known as Rigel Kent, the larger of the pair, is only 1.079 solar masses, but 151% as bright as our Sun, and again, 3 times brighter than Toulomin. Coincidentally, their combined mass is almost twice our Sun's, and their combined brightness almost twice our Sun's too. I say coincidentally because usually 2 stars with the same combined mass as our Sun would have nothing like its brightness. For instance, most stars are less than half as massive as our Sun, and a star half our Sun's mass would either be a dead and usually dim white dwarf, or more likely, an orangish-red dwarf, and on the main sequence still, since no star that started at that mass, even one as old as the universe, would be more than a fraction of the way through its life. It would have a luminosity of just 0.4% of our Sun's, so it would take 250 of them to match our Sun's brightness, and its habitable zone would be only a 15th as wide as ours, at about 7% of an AU. While a star with that remaining mass, 1.5 solar masses, would be an F1 star on the main sequence, and 6.17 times brighter than our Sun, and more than 1,500 times brighter than its red dwarf partner, even though it was only 3 times more massive. And it would be growing brighter as it aged too, and it probably would only live 3 billion years, which might put it out of the habitable zone, at least for intelligent life, in a temporal rather than spatial sense. We'll return to age in a moment, but that massive imbalance in brightness tends to be more the norm than the exception, and for a close binary pair, it will often mean that the second star is mostly irrelevant to the habitability so long as they are much closer than the habitable zone is wide. We'll cover 2 interesting exceptions at the end. Alpha Centauri A and B are further from each other than their habitable zones are wide, so any planet orbiting both are too cold for life, and any orbiting A are seeing something far brighter in the night sky than our moon is, but not one that helps much with life and temperature. We will dip into them more later in the episode, but a planet in B or Toulomin's habitable zone would see a small rise or drop in temperature when A, Rigel Kent, was closest or furthest in its 79-year orbital period, but it is minimal. Alternatively, Alpha Centauri C, or Proxima Centauri, isn't even a bright star in the night sky of A or B, and effectively irrelevant to the habitability of either. We are not even sure if it is a true trinary system. Proxima might just be near them and passing by, or newly joined, though a distant binary or trinary on orbits of tens of thousands of years might affect habitability if it was quite eccentric in its orbit and got in close during perihelion or dragged a lot of comets along with it. Indeed, the idea that our Sun might have a dim red dwarf or brown dwarf partner was a very popular one for a long time, and it was nicknamed Nemesis because its proposed distance would result in an orbital period of 26 million years, which we thought we saw a pattern of mass extinctions occurring at. Only relatively recently have we been able to rule out any Nemesis-like partner as big or bigger than Jupiter, and a better fossil record has pointed away from 26 million year cycles of extinction. Very popular idea in science and science fiction, though, probably best known for my namesake Isaac Asimov's excellent novel Nemesis, or The Red Star with its 200-year cycle of destruction from Anne McCaffrey's Pern series, another of my favorites growing up, indeed the second sci-fi author I read right after Douglas Adams, though I enjoy it just as much now as when I was a younger age. And returning to age, it is a huge factor in binary habitability, more than in single star systems, in fact, mostly because stars grow brighter as they age, and more massive ones age faster. What's more, we have white dwarf binaries like Sirius B, and that B indicates it's the second brighter of the two stars, but while Sirius A is the brightest star in our own night sky, and gives off 25 times as much light as our own sun, both are less than a tenth of our sun's own age, and Sirius B, the white dwarf remnant, is actually more massive than our own sun, and while only half the mass of Sirius A now, would presumably have been 5 to 6 times more massive than our sun before it went red giant and a few hundred times brighter, and indeed many thousands of times brighter when it was a red giant. We discussed this in greater detail earlier this week in Colonizing White Dwarfs, but you might easily find a binary system where such a star once lived and was now a white dwarf, or neutron star or black hole for that matter, and its once smaller and dimmer binary partner lived on with planets. Even if that binary partner, now deemed A instead of B, were merely a red dwarf, it would still be brighter than any white dwarf or neutron star, especially after a long enough time that life had arisen. The Sirius system is only a quarter of a billion years old, and Sirius B died around 100 million years ago, not much time for life to arise and prosper. As we discussed earlier this week, while there are bad spots to seek naturally occurring life, these remain good targets for colonization, as contrary to what sci-fi implies, a supernova does not automatically obliterate planets, and their charred remains might unchar after a long enough time. We'll focus more for now, though, on contemplating binaries where habitable planets might naturally exist and be long-term stable. This means we're either contemplating a system that is not a true binary system for brightness' sake, one where one of the stars has become a dim remnant, or we're contemplating stars where the most massive is no more than 20 or 30% brighter than our sun, which would be enough to let Mars be Earth-like temperature. Now, of course, many binaries are very stable and long-lived, but separated by dozens or hundreds of AU. We discussed the case of Alpha Centauri already, and more in the episode Colonizing Alpha Centauri, and more in a bit. It's a popular star system to discuss, after all, as our nearest neighbor, and again, those binaries have a period of 79 years, and never get closer than 11 AU or further than 36 AU. Think never as close as Saturn and never further than Pluto. For cases where they are further or dimmer, your main concern is gravitational perturbation of planets or mass cometary bombardment scenarios like Nemesis, or possibly alien mega-microbe invasion like with McCaffrey's Pern. And while that case is unlikely, a panspermia event spreading life between binary systems is plausible enough. Needless to say, though, that's hardly a trivial group of concerns, but not a big one for habitable zones themselves. This would often be the case for trinary systems, too, where two were closer and either orbited something bigger, which is very likely to be short-lived, and in as a neutron star or black hole, or they got orbited by something smaller like Alpha and Proxima Centauri. So we'll bypass this case, too, beyond noting as a situation where people are very used to seeing something far brighter than the moon in their night sky, indeed often in the day sky, but which otherwise has minimal effect on them. We're really only interested in binary cases where both stars contribute a significant part of the light to warming a planet, though we do want to be mindful that a habitable planet and a habitable star system are not the same thing. And so you could have cases where the planet intelligent life formed on really only relied on one star for sunlight, but their best candidates for settlement relied on the other or both. And indeed, you could easily imagine a case where both Toleman and Rigel Kent had a habitable planet or two in Alpha Centauri and was much more viable for colonization than imagining us going there, a journey modern ships could make without much more difficulty than a trip to Mars, and where communication time lags are still on order of an hour, not 4.5 years. This makes trade, and for that matter war, a lot more plausible and practical too. In any event, this gives us 3 examples of how planets might exist around a binary, or with some modification, a trinary system. The first 2 cases are fairly trivial. Case 1, the 2 stars are much closer together than the planet orbiting them. These are probably close binaries, which in astronomical terms means one's close enough to exchange mass from their outer atmosphere, and which also means that once the bigger one goes red giant, it will encompass that other star, and later when it becomes a white dwarf, it is going to nova, if not supernova. Not a high-priority colonization target, and really only viable for habitable planets if both stars are actually fairly large, are sun-sized to the nominal upper limit of 1.3 solar masses, as that would have a 5-billion-year main sequence life. That star would have a habitable region 60% wider than our own sun, and if we threw in a smaller K-type star orbiting as far out as Mercury at, say, 70% of our sun's mass, then it would have 30% of our brightness, and you would have a close but not too close binary pair around which an Earth clone would orbit at 1.67 AU, just a hair farther out than Mars, but with as much sunlight. This planet is orbiting once every 557 days, and half again our own year length, and during that time it will have occasions where the secondary star is more than half an AU further or closer to them than at other times of their year. Though those 2 inner stars are orbiting each other every 81 days, about a 1/7 of our year. The calendar here in terms of seasons might be a very screwy one, though it is likely your planet is going to end up in a resonant orbit that's an exact multiple of that star's orbital period. We'll talk about other screwy season scenarios in next week's episode on the Banks orbital megastructure, which I actually recorded before this, since I keep coming back and tinkering with the script. Returning to our example, since you're all moving around those suns while they move around each other, this is probably something like a 90 to 100 day period between when the secondary star repeats its closest approach to you, and this is going to be producing sunlight changes as significant as summer and winter here on Earth, but over a much shorter interval, more like our season than year in duration. Factor in your own axial tilt, and you can get some extreme weather variation. Nor can we ignore tidal forces, which are likely to be very significant, and which for dimmer dwarfs replaces varying sunlight as the variable making this a rough place to live, as well as what permits it to live. They're the fuel for the fire, keeping you warm, but often burning you, so to speak. Note that a rough place to live isn't the same as an impossible place to live, but we need to be mindful this is a very perturbation-prone system with changing lighting and twice as many chaotic effects like solar storms. Probably more, too. Tidal effects of stars on each other can cause more eruptions. As we noted earlier, most binaries are not very similar in brightness to each other, and there's not going to be many stable configurations that allow that lesser binary to significantly contribute to lighting a habitable planet without also either capturing or ejecting it from orbit. Though by significant lighting, we mostly mean heat and photosynthesis. Even way out at Pluto, where the sun is 1/1000 as bright, it's still 100 times brighter than the full moon. That's going to impact biology, and its cultural effect is going to be huge, too. Now, case 2 we can mostly skip. This is our case where the other binary is too far away to contribute any real sunlight or much gravitational effect. It's still a lot of nighttime lighting, though, and over its period of a century or more, it will be visible during the nighttime during 1/2 the year, and then not the other. And even for those a bit further apart than Alpha Centauri's binaries, over its period of a century or more, it will be visible during the nighttime during 1/2 the year and then not the other. It's the extra bright moon lighting up your winter skies for a century, and then it will brighten your spring nights for a century, then your summer, then fall. It is probably what your calendar uses for your next increment after days and years, and it may be many decades or even a few millennia, depending on how bright and close it is. Of course, brightness is going to vary with how close it is, and that can vary a lot too, as orbits are rarely circular. And as mentioned, Alpha Centauri A and B orbit each other every 79 years and vary elliptically, from 11 AU to 36 AU in distance, meaning some planet orbiting Alpha Centauri B, again also called Ptolemy, is watching Alpha Centauri A, also called Rigel Kent, vary over 8 decades from something 400 times dimmer than our own sun, 1,000 times brighter than the full moon, to 140 times dimmer than our sun, brighter than a cloudy day. and at both distances visible during daytime. That probably isn't a deal-breaker, and we can't imagine life managing that difference easily enough, but anything more than that would probably make life non-viable, with either deadly hot summers for a couple of decades, or ultra-cold winters for the same. Obviously, this case relies on a fairly elliptical orbit, which is neither rare nor normal. Alpha Centauri C, or Proxima, again, is barely visible, as at its distance of 13,000 AU from the others, a fifth of a light year, it is 100 billion times dimmer in their sky than our own sun is in ours. It would be a fifth magnitude star, the kind only visible on very clear nights far from any light pollution. Incidentally, Proxima is not visible from Earth except by telescope, and even then in the southern hemisphere. So, case 1 is a planet orbiting both stars, and case 2 is orbiting just one, but with a neighbor close enough to be a brightest moon or even a major climate changer over the course of its decades to centuries-long orbit. Let's consider the third case, a planet orbiting the bigger star, which is orbited by another star on a bit more of a circular orbit. Probably still elliptical, but not sharply so, which helps minimize perturbation. The issue here is that this second sun plays a role a lot like Jupiter, and indeed probably has its own solar system, but it needs to be further away than Jupiter for there to be any chance of stable orbits around either star. In a case like this, you have more likelihood it's a dim red dwarf on the smaller side orbiting something dim too, as that forces any habitable planets to be very close to their stars. This is quite common since most stars are much smaller than our sun, and many binaries are red dwarf pairs. Or a red and orange dwarf, or even involve a brown dwarf, though it's debatable if they count as a star. We don't tend to think of it this way, but the bigger a star is, the brighter it is, and the more easily disturbed and perturbed objects in its habitable zone are. Whatever your lighting is like, you can't exist long as a planet if it's either shifting radically all the time, or if your planet is getting ejected into the interstellar void by perturbation, or swallowed by its sun. To wrap up with an interesting pair of examples, let's imagine a tidally locked planet around a smaller red dwarf, that it orbits about once a month, and further out beyond that we have another star, a very slightly dimmer red dwarf that orbits about once a year. That means during the normal course of events, the day side of our planet is always under sunlight, a monstrously large but dim sun, and then we can often see that other star that's about a tenth as bright in the sky. We see it for around 2 weeks at a time, then it sets and rises again 2 weeks later. During that time, the eternal night side is brighter, enough to feel like a cloudy day, followed by 2 weeks of utter darkness. But over the course of the longer year, we will be closer or further from that secondary sun, so we basically have several month-long cloudy days that are increasingly brighter, followed by zenith, then waning to more dark days. This place is also very tidally racked, because that second sun is still very massive, just dim, so it might indeed be a very stormy place, and still fairly warm from tidal heating and air currents. I could picture living in some mining city there, built into a volcanically active island, living on a diet of mostly fish and mushrooms, trading to the twilight realms and Sunnyside for other food. It would be an interesting place to be a ship captain during their age of sail, too. Gloomy seas for weeks at a time, followed by eternal dark for two more, on a planetary hemisphere that was some mix of Iceland, fjords, and massive whirlpools. We could also flip that case around. Our planet around the smaller star, and them orbiting the bigger binary. A red dwarf with a close habitable planet that orbits a star like our own, but maybe at Martian distance, in which case that planet is probably tidally locked, and one side always sees the red dwarf and the other not, but depending on the brightness and mass of that red dwarf, it may orbit it anywhere from once every few days to a few months, and get light on one side or another from that bigger and more distant sun on that same time frame. So, for a quick example, a 2-week orbit around a red dwarf not quite bright enough to warm that world on its own has one side eternally lit by it, and lit by that other sun for a week, then dark for a week, while the other side never sees that close red sun, doesn't know its binary, and is dark for a week and dimly lit by the bigger sun for a week, then once again dark. To the best of my knowledge, that's never been written up as a setting for any novel, either of them, so feel free to steal one and set a tale there, and there's a lot of interesting trinary cases of a similar variety. But that's where we'll wrap our own tale up for the moment. As we saw today, the habitability of binary star systems, and even regular star systems, can be a bit non-intuitive and require some calculation to understand. Math can sometimes be intimidating for those who want to learn more on these topics, and people can even trick themselves into thinking it can't be done, even though they know it will open up whole new worlds to their imagination and help with professional growth, too. But it can be done, especially with the help of a good partner like Brilliant. The best way to learn is daily, and establishing a daily learning habit is one of the most important things you can do, learning in fun and bite-sized chunks, and that's where Brilliant can help. Brilliant helps you build real knowledge in minutes a day, with fun lessons you can do whenever you have the time. Brilliant also focuses on fun and interactive learning, where you learn by doing, with thousands of interactive lessons in science, math, data analysis, programming, and AI. From simple to complex, whatever your skill level, Brilliant customizes content to fit your needs and lets you start where you should and improve at your own pace. Brilliant has been a partner to this show for many years now, and you can trust them to be a partner on your learning journey. But you can try everything Brilliant has to offer first for free for a full 30 days. Just visit brilliant.org/IsaacArthur or click on the link in the description. You also get 20% off an annual premium subscription. Thinking on long-term friends and partners, whenever I'm doing a follow-up or sequel to an episode from years back, it tends to spark my memory of when that episode was getting made, and today's episode was no exception. And ironically, while first written a year ago, before being expanded for today, it was first planned 4 years ago, and put on the back burner because it was right after COVID came out and I switched some channel focus in favor of episodes like our Becoming an Interplanetary Species series. I'd originally been planning to give that as a talk while accepting my Pioneer Award at the International Space Development Conference, which got canceled that year, and I decided to make it first an episode and then a series. And it was very popular with that organization, the National Space Society, and 4 years later, I'm the president of that organization. Another thing that got put on the back burner from COVID was my old Army Battalion's long-planned forced reunion, and that was also just when my wife Sarah and I had gotten married right after the shutdown. She was hoping to go to both events with me, but we couldn't go, and even our honeymoon had to be shortened from COVID. That battalion reunion finally got rescheduled this year in Las Vegas for this weekend, and I wanted to wish all my former battle brothers from 23FA, the 2nd Battalion of the 3rd Field Artillery Regiment, proudly serving in virtually every conflict since the War of 1812, a great time there in Vegas. I could not have had any better luck than to serve in 23FA alongside all of them. Unfortunately, my 4th anniversary is this weekend too, so Sarah and I will be off enjoying a long-needed vacation when this episode airs. As I'm sure most of you know, I create these episodes well in advance, so no, if you're wondering, I am not working on my vacation beyond probably spending about 10 minutes releasing and checking on this episode. My wife might kill me otherwise. Speaking of upcoming episodes, though, we'll begin May 2024 with a look at the Banks Orbital, also known as God's Bracelet, a megastructural space habitat hundreds of times larger than Earth that advanced civilizations might build as an alternative to terraforming planets. And speaking of advanced civilizations, the week after that, on Thursday, May 9th, we'll look at the interdiction hypothesis of the Fermi Paradox, which asks if civilizations out in the galaxy might leave large buffer zones between their empires, and ask if Earth might be inside one such empty buffer zone. Then we'll continue the alien theme with a look at the reverse case of interdiction, where civilizations sprawl near each other and set up alien embassies. After that, it's on to the idea of massive galactic empires and the enormous cosmic capitals that might oversee them. If you'd like to get alerts when those and other episodes come out, make sure to hit the like, subscribe, and notification buttons. You can also help support the show on Patreon. And if you'd like to donate or help in other ways, you can see those options by visiting our website, IsaacArthur.net. You can also catch all of SFIA's episodes early and ad-free on our streaming service, Nebula, along with hours of bonus content, like Galactic Beacons, at go.nebula.tv/IsaacArthur. Thanks for watching, and have a great week!